Okay, so yes, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. And I think there's a lot of debate, and therefore I'm happy to discuss this. I'm not a theoretician, I'm the material side, from the material side, but I think also somewhere Philip Moll should be here in the room, because he did similar things. So I have to thank all the theoreticians. We are making millions of crystals trying to verify all your predictions. So in this sense, I have to thank the audience, okay?
That's nowhere near a million.
No, we have more, but I think we should. Okay, anyway, so we are interested in topological materials. So our design scheme was so far always to look for bent inversions in materials, and to see whether if we have this band overlap, we can open up the full band gap, get a topological insulator with a surface state, or whether we have a partially opening up of the band gap and having Weissimi methods or Dirac. I don't want to talk about this, but the criteria for having, for example, Weil, and I talk about Weil a little bit at the beginning, is that people are looking for the Fermi arc between the Weil points, because we have this chiral Weil points, which are resulting from a Dirac point at a high symmetry point, and we are looking for something like the chiral anomaly. So for me, from the materials perspective, it's always like if you apply magnetic field at this two Y points, you can transfer charge from one to the other Y point, and then the material behaves more or less. This is what the theoretical prediction, like a magnetic material. We have zirconium telluride, which shows an anomalous Hall effect, or a negative magnetoresistance effect, which we normally see from magnetic material. So all the materials I'm talking about today is like, I start with niobium phosphide, simple materials, binary materials, which are grown by chemical vapor transport, and they are quite clean. So I think they are much cleaner than if you grow a single crystal by Bridgman or other methods. So we get very nice single crystals. And in this Weil semi-metals, you have Weil points and you have this electron and hole pocket. This is simply because the Weil points are, so it's different from the nice graphene, where you have only one band crossing this at the Fermi energy, the p electrons. Very often in Weil semi-metals, you simply have electrons and hole pockets, plus the crossing points, Dirac or Y points, because you have more bands around the Fermi energy. So you never can avoid the electron hole pocket. So some of the properties are maybe related to electron hole pockets or to Y points. So it's not fully distinguishable. Okay, so the first thing what you do normally, you look whether your material has a Fermi arc. And this is the case in niobium phosphide. So these are calculated, these are measured APIS data. So I don't want to go more into this detail. So I have chosen niobium phosphide as an appetizer at the beginning, because it's also an interesting thing, system, I still think, also from maybe hydrodynamic. So all these materials have something in common. This Y semi-metal is very similar to, like, I think this is also like graphene. So you have, in the, most of the material, very, very high ratio between the resistance at room temperature and the resistance at low temperature. And most of them have quite low resistance at low temperature. And if you apply magnetic field, you see what you also know from bismuth. You change even the slope of the resistivity curve, and it looks like there's a plateau. And this is a common feature of all the semi-metals. And since we are close to compensation, so we have, then we can calculate the mobilities of this material. And very often, we have very large mobilities comparable to what we know from graphene. And if we, with temperature, we change from electron to hole conductivity, for example. So we looked in this material for the electronic structure, and all these materials show very nice quantum oscillations. This is why Jan Zahn doesn't like tungsten phosphide so much, because they all have nice quantum oscillation. So we really can assign the whole band structure by our by the torque measurements, which were done by Elena Hassinger. And here, in this case, we found out that the Y points are 5 millievolt above the Fermi energy and 60 below the Fermi energy. So this explains why we don't see a negative magnetoresistance. So what Johannes did, and this was the starting point, he was interested in thermal transport, and he made a micron ribbon out of niobium phosphide, in this case, with a FIP, focus ion beam. So the micron ribbon was slightly gallium doped. The effect of this, so again, you see the in the all the transport measurements, the very nice quantum oscillation. The effect of this, the sample was doped so that now the wild points were at the Fermi energy, and we saw the negative magnetoresistance effect. We saw a positive magnetoresistance effect if the field is perpendicular to the current, and we see a negative magnetoresistance effect if the field is in parallel. So we think this is not due to current shedding, etc. This is a real negative magnetoresistance effect. So, but his original idea was to look for thermal transport, and we thought, okay, he measured Seebeck, Nernst, etc. So, but he found out that there was a very nice paper from Subir Sachich's group, who is in the audience, about what we should measure. And this is a nice thing. We have the crystals, and then we go to the literature. And if we are able to understand the serial paper, and this is a serial paper which I even can read. So there were already predictions what we should see. So in magneto-thermoelectric conductance in this material, if the thermal gradient is parallel to the B field, very similar to the voltage parallel to the B field, we should see at low field a quadratic behavior, and at high field it should diminish. So this was a prediction by theory, and what we saw exactly is we saw the gravitation, the expected value for the chiral anomaly in the normal transport. But if we applied the thermal gradient, and Johannes is an expert who really knows what he does in thermal conductivity, he comes from the field of thin film and nanowires thermoelectric transport. He saw exactly what Subir predicted. So he saw a B field, a square behavior with a B field around small field, and it's diminishing. If you apply higher field. So this was very nice, and I still think that the hydrodynamics should be in the paper, but the referee 3 didn't like the hydrodynamics, so we had to remove the hydrodynamic here in this, but we, I think, still have to see the hydrodynamic part. But there was also, the nice thing is also there was this interesting connection to the gravitational anomaly, which made the paper into Nature because it has a fancy title and even into into New York Times. Okay, so this is was the first system where we started to think about hydrodynamics, and luckily we had Annie McKenzie in our department, so we heard about his fantastic work on palladium cobalt 2 in together with his very nice work on the graphene. And so we could learn about what you should see else in hydrodynamic to really show the hydrodynamic properties. So at the same time, I have to say we found another material which looked even better to us, this tungsten phosphide 2, which is simply a very protected wild semi metal, because here we have the situation that we have, so normally if you have a simple wild, you start theoretically from Dirac, you change the crystal structure by distortion, or you apply magnetic field, you get your wild points. Here, normally the Dirac point is 4 times degenerated. Here in this material, if you would assume inversion symmetry, you would have an 8-fold degeneration. You split it up in 4 pairs of wilds. And here we have now the situation that the wild points who are next to each other have the same chirality. So they are much more stable, we think, against disorder. This might be the reason why this material shows these fantastic properties. So we could grow, again, with chemical vapor transport these very nice single crystals, and this is, again, the resistivity as a function of magnetic field, and this is, again, looks very similar like niobium phosphide. What you see always at a certain temperature, so at high temperatures, the resistance is always the same, independent from magnetic field, and then you see this strong field dependence. And here, again, it looks like a topological insulator, I have to say. You see it more, it looks like the semi-metal which has this plateau. And this material had extremely high RR value, which you only know from very clean kappa, which is several times cleaned, and so on. And the other advantage of this crystal is that this is like a needle. So if you have, if you put a little bit pressure on this needle with maybe put it between 2 glasses, then you can get many small needles. And this is exactly this was done on the needles. And what is interesting, maybe also as an information for the theoretician, we had at high field here, normally we have even at lower field, very nice quantum oscillation, and we could assign all the calculated Fermi surface. So we have this one-dimensional spaghetti-like open Fermi surface, might be important, I don't know, for this hydrodynamic flow and this bow tie kind of Fermi surface. But what is interesting is that the values we get out of the effective mass of the electrons is much higher than what we get out of the DFT calculation. So this was not the case in the niobium phosphide and oil. It's not as large, the enhancement is not as large in other white semi methods. Normally DFT works rather well. So this was the difference. So tungsten phosphide is in some sense then very different because you have to have a large magnetoresistance effect and a very high conductivity. So therefore we thought, okay, also because this would lead to a mean free path and this again very high mobility of half a millimeter, we thought this is maybe the system to go, especially also we could cleave it into small needles without using focus ion beam. So, and at the same time, Andy and Joan Moore, they did this very nice paper, which also is easy to understand for even somebody who is in material science. So they gave exactly the recipe how to should to look for hydrodynamic flow in this material. So you should have really a resistivity which goes proportional to the width to the square. So Johannes again here made this materials, which is really, so we don't think that we have any destroyed sites or something, because we simply can get the natural smaller single crystals out of this, so we could easily make four different widths of the material, and this is what you see. You see also that the conductivity up to 150 Kelvin doesn't change. It's independent from the width. And then if you see, so 0.9 micrometers already much smaller by one order of magnitude than the single crystal. We saw already the dependence of the single crystals from the widths. So you see nicely how it changes. And here it even shows a small upturn. And I'm sure you can even drive it in this direction if you make it still smaller. So then if you look for the width dependence of the resistivity, and this log resistivity versus log width, you see you have up to this temperature really perfect Rudy behavior. There's no dependency, and then it goes fully to the square behavior. So we think there's evidence for really for hydrodynamic flow in this material. So the second experiment he did then was thermal transport of this material. Since this is his expertise, he measured thermal conductivity and additionally to the electronic conductivity. And you see really also a similar behavior as a function of temperature. And you see there's a strong violation of the Wiedemann-Franz law at very low temperature in this material. So it looks the same here, like the width dependence of the resistivity looks also very similar, like the thermal, violation of the Wiedemann-Franz law. So and I gave this talk in a material science conference, and then somebody, so Antoine Meunier came and said, look, I know about the work from, and I always talk about the work of Philip Moll, who is also here in the audience. So he showed the width dependence of palladium cobalt O2. But it seems to be that before he even measured, somebody measured the Wiedemann-Franz, the thermal conductivity also here, and this is Antoine Meunier, also from the community of thermoelectric people, and they find also a violation of the Wiedemann-Franz, not as strong as in tungsten phosphide too, but even with a nice upturn, which maybe makes Steve more happy than, no, because you see some upturn. Okay, and you see also very similar magnetoresistance effect in palladium cobalt O2, like in the tungsten phosphide. Also here you see as a function of the field. You see, it looks like a topological insulin. Okay, so this was what I told him. Look, I think the magnetic field dependence is also very strange in this material. He should look what happens with the magnetic field. We should learn something about the magnetic field dependence. So he went to the literature, and again, some smart theoretician wrote some magnetohydrodynamic model in the Navier-Stokes flow limit. So he fitted our data, our experimental data, with the prediction, the theoretical prediction, and this is a great fit. And you see that the size-dependent resistivity multiplied by the width to the square as a function of B field looks exactly what is predicted by magnetohydrodynamic. So with all this data, he was able to get the momentum relaxation time out of all the data and the thermal energy relaxation time. And I think he could get it even from different measurements. And what was interesting, because he likes always to have a fancy title for the paper, which I don't care so much, but okay, young people like it, Planckian bound of dissipation. So he sees that all this momentum relaxation times lies on the bound of dissipation, which I know Jan Zahn doesn't like, but maybe there's an explanation, but these are the data. So it looks like at high temperatures, momentum relaxation time dominates, and at low temperature, the thermal energy relaxation time dominates. It's interesting, so it seems to be that these times are very different and therefore distinct. So it looks like for us that this are really convincing results for hydrodynamic flow. I hope it convinced you too. So you can calculate then a viscosity in this material, which is slightly temperature dependent out of the data. Similar, like, I think it's also in the order of magnitude as far as I know, like graphene, no? So anyway, so but I have the right to be a little bit more naive since I'm a material scientist. I said, look, so if we have this kind of behavior like a topological insulator and a magnetic field, maybe one sees something in the optical spectra. We didn't do so far optical measurement from tungsten phosphide 2, but from tantalum arsenide and niobium phosphide. And in both of the systems, I went back to my optics colleagues and they say, indeed, we see a gap. This is, if you fit it, it goes with a gap of 10 milliev. Indeed, they see also something like that electrons, part of the electrons are gapping. You still have some Ruder electrons, which might be not, even if I'm very naive, I think, at the end one should measure quantum Hall effect in this kind of material. So there might be really something field dependent which gaps. Okay, so if I have 3 minutes, I simply can say we have another system, and this was the original system which made us a little bit curious, because we measured also the conductivity of MO phosphide, which is a triple point fermion system. It was predicted, also already shown in APRS. And you see the crystal looks really nice. Okay, the system, it's always only a small picture of the, but we also think here, and our 10 people think it's extremely nice crystal. And here's a story started. So when we measured this conductivity, we had problems to measure it in the PPMS. What do you do as a material scientist? You go to Andy McKenzie, your neighbor, the physicist, and say, look, I think my machine is broken. He was very unhappy because he said, the data are even better than my palladium cobalt or so. No, he was not very unhappy because he's a very nice person. He helped us. He gave us his dilution fridge, and we did it with Michael Niklas to get nicer data. And even in a metal, so we see that we still have can measure a Hall effect and see a high mobility. Here we think we have 10 to the power of 22 is the electron concentration, and we have this high mobilities, which might lead again to this nano-ohm conductivity. So we also can see here the quantum oscillation, and we can assign all the Fermi surfaces to this. And since we had, and we see also here this magnetoresistance effect, since we had no possibility so far, so Philip Moll is working on MO phosphide, and this is now a prediction. So this we think there is maybe, this is in the gray area, maybe of hydrodynamic flow, similar like palladium cobalt or 2. So here the mean free path is something like 11 micrometer, not as large as in tungsten phosphide 2. But we think we see some evidence already if we look into the specific heat and compare this with the conductivity. So it looks like that in this Fermi liquid, which we still assume, is that the momentum relaxation mean free path of the electrons should be also 100 times larger than the dissipative quantum lifetime. So this is to see, and this is a new idea from Johannes, I have to say, in the modified Kadowaki-Woods ratio. So the MO phosphide lies here in the lower part, which means it's not a highly correlated system. I said to Johannes, okay, you cannot say highly correlated, you get into serious trouble. There seems to be some interesting correlation between the electrons, which might be the reason, and we will see whether it also shows the hydrodynamic flow. So you want to ask me question, I want to ask you question. So I think I already learned that the first question is not important, because I think already Steve told me there, so we can even do the channels with MO phosphide. It doesn't matter. We don't have to wait for a 3D hydrodynamic model. But we would like to have a recipe also how to find more materials where we find hydrodynamic properties. So it would be nice to have a descriptor for hydrodynamic materials from the perspective of this. And what we saw also, maybe there's a nice prediction, because we thought that all this material seems to have also very large Nernst effect. Maybe there's something which one can connect also. Okay, this is, I thank you for your attention.
Yes, you will be my assistant in
asking questions.
Let me just start on that side.
You gave the Curie number 5 times 10 to the 20. Mm-hmm. What is the Fermi energy?
Oh, good question. I know it. It's in the paper, but I don't know it. I think it's...
But it's safely a lot larger than temperature.
Yeah, exactly.
Steve, that's great.
Yeah, so it went fast. Can you go back to the paper slide where you showed the resistivity for different width samples as a function of temperature? So the resistivity is always an increasing function of temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm very puzzled by this, because the hydrodynamic theory, the resistivity of this channel should be proportional to the viscosity.
Mm-hmm.
The viscosity should be proportional to the inelastic mean free path, the momentum conserving mean free path.
Mm-hmm.
So in a Fermi liquid, that should go like 1 over T squared.
Mm. Exactly.
And even if it's not a Fermi liquid, if it's got your tau goes like T, it should be going like 1 over T. But in either case, it should be a decreasing function of temperature.
This will be true. Steve, when you are at finite density, viscosity actually becomes direct proportional entropy as an extra factor of T. Perhaps show that. I also saw that. And that goes like 1 over T.
It
could fly.
So why isn't the resistivity proportional to the viscosity?
I have the same question.
Where did you get, where is this measured?
How is this measured?
Viscosity.
So the viscosity is, I think we got the viscosity out of the data. So this is extracted from the...
So then go back to the original. So are you saying that I just can't see it, at low temperature, the sign?
The black one is the small, and the red one is the big channel.
Okay, so I should be looking at the narrowest one, the black one, and I see a decreasing resistance.
Yes.
So that, and but then why is it still? I mean, the other ones don't seem to be. They seem to have changed their temperature derivative, or am I? No, just looking at the. If we blow up the lowest temperature part.
So this small part here.
Yeah.
Yes, most of them are quite flat, and here it's a small increase.
So what was the you have one formula, which is rho goes like eta over w squared.
Yeah.
Okay, so we see the w squared, but they should have the same temperature dependence if they're determined by the viscosity. And
so you think this temperature dependence is slightly different?
No, I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about the low,
low temperature. Yeah, but the low temperature is more or less flat if you would blow this up. Okay. Here it's a little bit larger.
So
that's not the
same. Okay.
So the plot of the viscosity.
Yeah.
So that's what Steve wants to see. But the connectivity or the resistivity
should
be proportional.
The same temperature dependence.
Exactly. in the... will reflect in about 8 kelvin.
It should be... you say the resistivity should be flat above 8 kelvin.
And, but it should be a decreasing function of temperature below 8 kelvin is the really...
A decreasing function of temperature. So it goes here slightly, but here it goes up, only here at the lowest.
Know, but according to your formula, it should have the same temperature dependence. Or am I confused?
No, there was a miscommunication.
Oh. No, I know the answer, Steve. Steve, I know the answer. I know the answer. It's in the supplement. Actually, your n is t dependent. That this n in that formula is actually t dependent over this. You have a plot in the supplementary material on your paper. The n, because I assume it's because they're multiple bands, but this n actually has quite a strong t dependence in a low temperature regime. That's what happens.
He knows my paper better. Oh, he knows
okay,
the topic.
We'd like to give you a severe
about
it.
Okay.
The next. Yeah. What is the thermal? How did you measure the thermal energy relaxation time?
So we didn't measure the thermal energy relaxation time. We get it out of the. I think these are all the fittings out of the thermal conductivity measurement.
Okay. Who is next?
I am next.
I know.
Yeah, you already.
There's one question.
So I have a comment on thermal conductivity. You see, you compared it with the other data, Philip Moore's data. It is very important to recover the Wiedemann-Franzl at zero temperature. Experimentally, this is a check. So here, of course, you have a large violation. But you see, in any system, in presence of inelastic scattering, you expect to have a downward deviation from the Lorentz and Sommerfeld numbers, and so the violation. And what was reported in graphene by Philip Kim's group is also something which happens at 100K. So normally, if there is no spin charge separation, one should recover Wiedemann-Franzl at zero temperature. And it is very important to check
to make another zero temperature.
No, because that would make the experimental result credible.
Okay. Because you expect something like this.
Yeah, exactly. So the one at the right, we can believe it. The one at the left, you can still have doubts.
Okay, so we have to do this. Okay.
We're really running out of time, but I take the liberty as the moderator to ask a very last question. Claudia, can you go back to the spot where I have the energy and momentum relaxation time? Yes, this one. And I want to ask a question to the audience. I think it's the elephant in the room. So Claudia presented all this evidence in the form of nice control oscillations, blah, blah, that this is supposedly a great Fermi liquid, right? I may do wild jobs. Who can reconcile the observation of these relaxation times with the seemingly free gas particle behavior that you see in quantum oscillation, blah, blah? Has anybody an idea? So I can conclude from this that we are just collectively completely confused about it.
Or stupid,
yeah, I don't know, yeah. That's a very striking, right? It's a complete paradox.
But I
still
think we should think also what are the consequences that graphene, okay, has a Dirac cone, we have white points, so we have also linear bands.
Yeah.
Is
that's
this a precondition for finding?
I don't think that there's in graphene any evidence, right, that you really hit this Planckian bound, is it?
Yeah, but it would be interesting now to see whether it's
I mean, the Planckian bound is a big deal.
That if it's in graphene, I think in graphene you didn't look for the magnetohydrodynamics, and it would be interesting to see whether you can get the, you should get the same out of your data.
This is not what you expect in the Fermi liquid.
Yeah.
No
but
way.
I think if we could see like it in another system like graphene or in palladium cobalt or two.
It's not about materials. This is about either you're a Fermi liquid or you're something very different from it. When you're very different from a Fermi liquid, you can have it, right? And how can it be that you see both behaviors? I guess we can collectively share this conclusion that we are likely stupid.
Okay,
stop. Time to end this session.
I only present the experimental.
Jürgen, can I call you in front as the next moderator? I give you this microphone. Then this gets lost.